It's the day of questions, so named because of the string of interrogators who approach him on this day spent in Jerusalem. The day began in chapter 11 with Jesus and his disciples making their way into the city when they encounter the fig tree, which Jesus had cursed the day before, and they see it now withered from the roots up. You remember the fig tree was fully leaved, but it had no fruit. And it was a picture of the nation Israel at this time, especially its leaders, who had all the ornaments of spirituality, but they were barren spiritually. And this reality is played out in the gospel account by the various attempts of the Jewish leadership to remove the Lord from the scene. First, as we saw last week, in their questioning him about the source of his authority. If you were with us, you know that. If not, they were hoping to trap him into saying something that would offend either the Roman government or the people at large. But he really brilliantly volleyed the question back to them with a question that they themselves were unwilling to answer. And so they will continue angry, increasingly frustrated, to attempt to find some ruse by which they can ensnare the Lord. And we're going to read and study two more of them in verses 13 through 27 of chapter 12. The first approach we'll see is a hostile one intended to trap him so that they might find a means to have him executed. And the second is a muddled attempt by a group of Sadducees who want to test him, but in their testing, they reveal their own ignorance. So we begin reading in verse 13. Then they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to him in order to trap him in a statement. They came and said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are truthful and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay?" But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, "Why are you testing me? Bring me a denarius to look at." They brought one. And he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" And they said to him, "Caesar's." And Jesus said to them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they were amazed at him. Some Sadducees, who say that there is no resurrection, came to Jesus and began questioning him, saying, "Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves behind a wife and leaves no child, his brother should marry the wife and raise up children to his brother." That's found, it's a provision found in the law. You can find it in Deuteronomy. "Well, there were seven brothers," verse 20, "and the first took a wife and died, leaving no children. The second one married her and died, leaving behind no children, and the third likewise, and so all seven left no children. Last of all, the woman died also. In the resurrection, when they rise again, which one's wife will she be? For all seven had married her." And Jesus said to them, "Is this not the reason you are mistaken, that you do not understand the scriptures or the power of God? For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. But regarding the fact that the dead rise again, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the passage about the burning bush, how God spoke to him, saying, 'I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob.' He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. You are greatly mistaken." Well, they're two very different topics presented to the Lord. One, the obligation to pay taxes. The other, about resurrection. But I hope and trust this morning that if we come to understand Jesus' words properly, there'll be a great opportunity for ourselves to benefit from this in our own conduct in the world. This appearance of an envoy of Pharisees and Herodians in verse 13 presents an odd combination. Mark says that they sent some of them to him. That probably means this group of chief priests and scribes and elders that had been unsuccessful at the end of chapter 11, and they're now trying a different angle by ambushing him through another approach. But the Pharisees and Herodians were far from allies. The Pharisees were, as you know, the keepers and defenders of the law of Moses. They had erected a system of legalistic behavior guidelines that were onerous to the Jews. The law was supposed to be a benefit to the people. They had made it a burden to them. They had sapped the vitality of the Old Covenant faith right out of it. And they hated Jesus because he had revealed their spiritual bankruptcy and he had rejected their traditions. The Herodians, on the other hand, they cared little about the law. And what we know about them suggests that they were friends with the world. They were associated with high people in high places. They were great compromisers who valued their position and their relationship with all these elites represented by the various houses of Herod, hence their name, the Herodians. They hated Jesus because he condemned their worldliness. And when the Lord had made his triumphant entry, we studied that a couple of weeks ago, into Jerusalem, it was 2 days earlier, the Pharisees would have bristled at the messianic significance of it, while the Herodians would have cringed at the royal flavor of it. One opposed it for religious reasons, the other would have opposed it for political concerns. We might say today that this was an alliance of conservatives and liberals. This was, the extreme right wing and the left who had come together. It would be like imagining today Sean Hannity and Nancy Pelosi uniting together, on some common venture. But beyond that, even, their positions on the issues they take up were diametrically opposed. The Pharisees resented the Roman tax, and they probably considered it, we'll talk about this, but the coin, what was inscribed on it, they probably considered that idolatry. While the Herodians, being supporters of the Herodian rulers, considered it appropriate for the Jews to pay taxes to the Romans. Well, what brought the two together, as you can surmise, was the one thing they had in common, their hatred of the Lord. Love, we know, unites, and so does enmity. The only thing that could have brought these two disparate groups together was their united collective intent to extinguish this one man who was threatening their beliefs and their position. The Lord Jesus Christ is a polarizing figure. He is a polarizing presence in the world. He was then, he is today. He makes to unite the most bizarre group of misfits and conflicting personalities, and then he makes them his church, his body here on earth, his representatives to mankind. Now, the church, we frequently try to compartmentalize ourselves into young churches and old churches and wealthy congregations and not so wealthy congregations, white churches, black churches, Korean churches, Indian churches, churches that like hip music, churches that don't like hip music very much. In other words, we resist in various ways what God means to reinforce in the Church of Jesus Christ. We are a diverse lot, the church is. And as the world, the unbelieving world, is confronted with the person of Christ and the truth about the work that he accomplished through the church, those who disbelieve him and oppose him likewise will often band together as really strange bedfellows in their enmity against the Lord. National identity, socioeconomic status, race, it doesn't matter when it comes to anti-Christian mentality and militancy. They all unite. We see this all the time. But the psalmist observed it long ago in Psalm 2. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. It's a description of the very thing that we see in this passage. And as the next verse of Psalm 2 goes on to assert, he who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. And that's essentially how the Son of God handles this attempt by the Pharisees and Herodians. In verse 14, we see their approach. You know what a sycophant is? A sycophant is somebody who kisses up to somebody important. Well, this is fake sycophancy. Is that a word? It's fake. They recognize that Jesus is the most awesome person. Verse 14, they come and say to him, "Teacher, we know that you are truthful and defer to no one. You're not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth." The interesting thing about this guile that they utter is that the things that they said about Jesus in order to try to force him into a corner were actually true. They recognize his virtues, but because they are enemies, they can only envy him and despise him for them because of their own impure hearts and motives. They cannot believe that the things that are self-evident about Jesus are really true about him. He must be an imposter. They think that by reminding Jesus in front of a crowd of onlookers that he is one who will never lie or give one answer to one group of people and a different answer to another group of people without regard to what any particular group might think, that he'll be forced to come out on one side or the other of this important issue expressed in verses 14 and 15 by their question, is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay? Well, the issue of Roman taxation was a very serious and volatile one for the Jewish population. It had been introduced into the Judean population around 6 AD, and it was kind of a tax just for the right of existence, really. It was a tribute tax. It went directly into the emperor's treasury, and it was required to be paid in the emperor's coin, the denarius. And the Jews resented it. For one thing, it was a reminder every time they had to pay it of their subjugation to the Roman Empire. But also, the coin trumpeted the divinity of the Caesar. And that was anathema to the Jews. The coin that was brought to the Lord in verse 16 was probably the denarius of Tiberius. On one side, it portrayed the emperor as the semi-divine son of the god Augustus and the goddess Livia, and it had an inscription in it. It was abbreviated, but the inscription read, "Tiberius Caesar Augustus, son of the divine Augustus." And on the reverse side, it read, "Pontifex Maximus," which meant chief priest. So, for many of the Jews with religious sensitivities, they resented the sacrilege of it. Others, like the politically oriented zealots, chafed at being compelled by Rome to pay it, and many of them didn't pay it in rebellion. And then there were the Herodians, who considered it a legitimate function of the government and thought that it was reasonable that as citizens, or as at least people who lived in the Roman Empire, that they should pay the tax. The question then that they posed to the Lord was it was a double-edged sword. No matter what answer he gave, he would antagonize one partisan group or the other. But more importantly, if in seeking to please the people, he rejected the Romans' right to collect the tax, the Herodians would then have the ammunition they needed to go to the governing authorities and accuse Jesus of being an insurrectionist, and that was an executable offense, and they could have Jesus arrested and killed. Either way, his enemies would win. But the Lord recognized their hypocrisy. That's what Mark says in verse 15 there. He knew it was a trap. And I think this is significant enough. I want to point it out. The Lord never wavered in truth. That was foundational for him. And because he never wavered in truth, and because he never wavered in conduct, when asked one of these types of questions, these posers that were supposed to get him, he could answer immediately. And so he does. He immediately calls for them to bring a denarius to look at. Unlike the Jewish leaders back in the last chapter who kind of put their tail between their legs and muttered out, "We don't know the answer," the Lord was going to give them their answer. And so holding up the coin for them all to see, he asked them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" And when they answered, "Caesar's," his verdict was immediate. It was very straightforward. "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." In other words, give to Caesar what is due Caesar, and give to God what is due God. Well, thankfully, the scriptures are clear on both counts about what those responsibilities are. The coin was a good object lesson about man's, especially a Christian person's, obligation to those who rule over us. It had Caesar's image on it, and that was a picture of his sovereignty over those who use the coin. For those Jews living in this day in the Roman province of Judea, Caesar and his representatives in the imperial government were the rulers whom God had placed in authority over them. And what Jesus was saying was that the people had an obligation to submit to their authority, including their right to impose taxes on them as an act of submission to God himself. Now, you know, in the New Testament, the apostles eventually expand on this. The apostle Paul in Romans 13 would write that every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. And he outlined the purpose, Paul did, he outlined the purpose of government in God's sovereign plan, to actually be God's minister to mankind for good and to be a deterrent to evil and wrongdoing. Paul wrote that, "Because of this, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God." He said, "Render to all what is due them. Tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor." Peter would teach the same thing. 1 Peter 2:13 through 17. "Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right." He said, "Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." So Jesus' teaching, more fully set forth in the New Testament, was that of submission to those whom God has placed in authority over us. And we're sometimes challenged by that. You know, we're told to honor the king, not just submit to the king, but honor the king. And politics is a volatile issue, always is, always will be, it is today. I've got a barber and Betty Sue. And Betty is a Democrat, And she loved Bill Clinton, and she loves Obama. And we have a lot of fun with each other. She's been my barber for many years. And Betty, and she hates George Bush. So during the Bush years, Betty told me this. She said, you know, I'm not going to sit up here and badmouth the president. I'm not going to do that. She said, I heard enough from these chairs when Clinton was president. All the bashing of the president, it made me sick. Betty the barber knows more about honoring those in power than a lot of Christians do, I'm afraid, today. Well, that's one thing. We're challenged by authority. Sometimes rulers are not very good. Sometimes they're foolish. Sometimes they're cruel. Sometimes they're unfair. We don't like to pay taxes. We especially don't like it when we consider them to be onerous. Will Rogers said the income tax has made more liars out of the American people than golf has. Someone told the story of a conscience-stricken taxpayer who wrote the IRS, "Dear sir, my conscience bothered me. Here is the $175 which I owe in back taxes." Then there was a P.S. at the end. "If my conscience still bothers me, I'll send in the rest." It's a rite of passage for young people when they enter into the workforce to get their first paycheck, look at it, see how much money the government is taking out of it, and scream bloody murder. I mean, that's my money. It also gives great pleasure to parents to see their kids say that. The phone rings. Why didn't you tell me how much they take of my money? That's my money, and that's true. But it's also true that to the degree that the rulers who have been put into authority by God have levied that tax, then that part of the money is theirs. It pains me to say that. We might even say that it belongs to God, since He is the one who put them in authority over us. In fact, some believe that that is part of what the Lord meant when He said, "And render to God the things that are God's." I think it's unlikely, but it's true that the principle that's found in those words would include submission, obedience to our government. Where there will be times, of course, when a Christian must not obey those in authority, but those are usually, you know, easy to discern. It's when the demands of authority contradict the things that are God's. That's when a Christian must resist the civil authorities. When a believer is asked to do something that is in direct conflict with a command of God, he has a higher authority to answer to. We see that illustrated early in the Christian church in Acts chapter 4. Peter and John have been arrested by the council of the Jews, the Sanhedrin, and they have been ordered, those in authority over them have ordered them not to bear witness anymore in testimony to Jesus Christ. And they answered them, Acts 4, 19 through 20, "Whether it is right in the sight of God to give heed to you rather than to God, you be the judge. For we cannot stop speaking about what we have seen and heard." And later in chapter 5, they say we must obey God and not man. In the Old Testament, too, there are examples. Maybe the best is found in the book of Daniel, and also in every elementary level Sunday school curriculum. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, three young Jewish exiles who were subject to an order by the king. The order was that everyone must bow down and worship the golden image that the king had set up, and the cost, the risk, the punishment for not doing it was that they would be thrown into the furnace of blazing fire. And of course, They refused to do that, and how the Lord honored their right understanding of the higher authority of God over their lives has become an enduring testimony of faithfulness to God and courage to obey God rather than man. There may be other circumstances as well when a believer must resist those in authority over them, when we're commanded to do something that is against our conscience or that it's immoral, unethical. We must resist obeying that kind of command. I heard an example of that this week. A man spoke at a breakfast I was at. He was a Vietnam vet. He was a Christian. Told the story of being in a firefight in Vietnam, and when it was a very dangerous situation, a heated battle. When it was finally over and decided in their favor, they had collected some prisoners, and I guess his commanding officer in the heat of the moment ordered this man, John, to execute the soldiers. And as a Christian, he told his commanding officer, "Sir, I will not obey your command, and I understand the implications of it, but I cannot do it. I'm a Christian, and that is against my beliefs. It's against what I know God would have me do." So these are exceptions to the biblical principle of submission to governing authorities and of Jesus' own words, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's." And what he said immediately after offered the counterbalance to that by adding, "And to God the things that are God." He rejected any idea of Caesar worship. His answer was just so brilliant. Brilliant and true. By saying what he did, "And to God the things that are God," he implicitly rejected any idea of Caesar worship, and he ensured that no one could make the claim that he agreed with what was implicit in the inscriptions and the image on the coin. He emphatically rejected the type of hubris which would confuse man, the creature, with God, the creator. What is it that belongs to God? He said, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God." What is it that belongs to God? Everything. Everything that exists and that we benefit from belongs to God, including the government that he places over us. No one, not Caesar, or any citizen of the Roman Empire, not the president or senators or representatives or any citizen of our country, none of us is exempt from owing to God what belongs to him. That means that you are not your own. You belong to God. We may not always act that way. We often live as if it is our right to be happy, our right to make our way in the world to the things that are our objectives and our goals. We want to live well. We have the right not to suffer the pains and indignities that seem to befall so many people. But over time, Christians learn that they belong to God. Paul learned that. He wrote in Galatians 2, verse 20, "I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me." In 1 Corinthians 6, he pleaded with that worldly Corinthian church. He said, "Do you not know that you are not your own? For you have been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body." You know, most of us live our lives as if they are ours to dispose of as we see fit. But Jesus' declaration here that we're to render to God the things that are God's is a call to a total consecration of ourselves in the service. And it's really a restating of what he had told the disciples all the way back in chapter 8. He said, "You need to set your mind on God's interests, not man's. You need to deny yourself, take up the cross, and follow me." So It's a call for a fundamental restructuring of our outlook on life and on the things that occupy each of our individual lives. How are you spending your life? How are you rendering to God the things which are God? That'd be a good exercise for each one of us to review the past week, to review the past month, to review the past year and say, how have I done that? Or has my agenda been nothing but my agenda? I was reading Leviticus 26 this week. You shouldn't be expected to go, oh yeah, Leviticus 26. That's a good one. But in Leviticus 26, in that chapter, God outlines for the nation Israel the blessings that will come to them if they obey Him as they render to God the things that are God's, along with the penalties of disobedience. It's much like you see in Deuteronomy also. But if you read it, it's a vivid contrast between the blessed state of rendering to God the things that are God's and a wretched state that comes about when you don't do that. And what we see here in the Gospel of Mark is that that is the exact thing that Israel had not done. God had promised them, if you'll obey me, if you'll render to God the things that are God's, I'm going to bless you beyond your wildest imagination. You'll be a great nation. Here they are, slaves, essentially, in subjugation to the Romans. That's why they were in this mess. They had not done that. It's why they were enduring the ongoing insult of Roman occupation and having to pay the poll tax in the first place. And it's often the reason that many Christians fail to enjoy the abundant life that's promised to them. Too many of us are missing out on the blessing of total consecration of our lives to God because we've replaced it with the empty things that the world has to offer. We're paying more taxes for our misplaced, more than taxes for our misplaced priorities. Well, the comment at the end of verse 11 indicates the reaction of the Pharisees and Herodians to this latest test of Jesus. They were amazed at him. It's always the case. Those who come to best him left his presence thoroughly defeated. But that only paved the way for the next wave of interrogators. The Sadducees approached him next. What we know about the Sadducees can be said in just a few words. We don't know that much. What we have been able to learn is that they were a sophisticated group within Judaism who considered themselves to be the elite of the ruling classes of the Jews. They were a stuffy sort who, because of their wealth, because of their connections, we know people like this, they were widely disliked. They were not the kind to intermingle with commoners. Their theology was distinctive in that they only recognized the scripture, the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, the Torah, and they were notorious in their opposition to belief in an afterlife. And in this, they and the Pharisees were in complete disagreement. And for this, the Pharisees looked down upon them. They didn't believe in resurrection, as Mark tells us here, nor did they believe really in the supernatural at all. They appear again, you remember, years later in Acts when the Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 23 he had been arrested. He was incarcerated in Jerusalem and he appears before the Sanhedrin, the Council of the Jews, and the Sanhedrin was made up of both Pharisees and Sadducees, and so Paul, in a stroke of genius, decides to make resurrection the bone of contention, knowing that that would send the Pharisees and the Sadducees in their spiral of arguing, and it worked. The whole place blew up. The two parties began arguing again over this long-standing dispute between themselves. And Luke states there in Acts 23 that the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. So they were materialists the Sadducees were, not at all like the Pharisees. But again, we see men who are enemies of one another unite in their opposition to Christ. So the Pharisees had had their turn, and now the Sadducees step up. They're going to give the Lord a little lesson in the Scriptures. They call him teacher, and they quote naturally from the law of Moses, verse 19. Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves behind a wife and leaves no child, his brother should marry the wife and raise up children to his brother. This was a reference to the levirate laws found in the Old Testament, set forth most clearly in Deuteronomy 25, the referenced in other places in the Old Testament. The word levirate, L-E-V-I-R-A-T-E, it's derived from the Latin word for a brother's brother, levir, levirate. And it was the designation given to a type of marriage that was designed to be a solution to an ancient problem. We don't have that problem so much today, but it was the ancient problem of the widowed and childless woman. By that I mean it was a different culture, a different time, and in those days a woman had only two places, her father's house as an unmarried virgin, or her husband's house where she was to produce children for him. A childless widow had no secure place in the ancient society. So this provision was made in the event that a woman's husband died while she was still childless. Her husband's brother was expected to marry her and raise up children in the dead brother's name, and in that way the family line would continue and their wealth would be preserved. So this was the background to this hypothetical case they presented to the Lord. It was probably one of their stock conundrums that they had in their arsenal, which they would pull out in order to buttress their argument against life after death. It had no doubt worked many times before for them, and they figured that today it would bamboozle this uneducated commoner that they were dealing with. A marriage that ended prematurely with the husband's death, leaving the wife childless and the man's brother taking his brother's widow for his own wife. Then he dies, the next brother assumes responsibility, and so on. Seven brothers total. Very unlikely, but better to make their point, don't you think? They ask him in verse 23, in the resurrection, when they rise again, which one's wife will she be? You see, because all seven had married her. See, this was the punchline to their, you know, kind of gotcha argument. And you can imagine how they must have relished the moment. But when you approach Jesus, it was not amateur hour. You see this in the Gospels again. When challengers ask the Lord a question, it's just so easy for him. It's not how we think of a sharp-minded person who has the gift of gab and they're just so good on their feet and they can talk their way out of any difficult question. That's not it at all. The Lord always responds forcefully and without hesitation because he doesn't have to search in his mind for the true answer. He is truth. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He's the only way to life, and he's the only source of truth. So if we're ever to truly know anything, we must attain it through Jesus Christ. And in this, the Sadducees were lacking. They didn't have true knowledge. They were ignorant. That's what the Lord tells them, verse 24. Isn't this the reason you're mistaken? You don't understand the Scriptures or the power of God. If they understood the Scriptures, they'd also understand the power of God, see? And their rationalistic minds would be fit to understand how God could raise people from the dead and give them life for eternity. Well, the answer is given in verse 25. The life to come is not going to be like this one. because our omnipotent God will make us into new creatures, different than we are today. That's the answer. When a Christian lives forever in heaven, we'll be the same, but we'll also be different. And I wanted time to do this, but I didn't leave myself. But 1 Corinthians 15, jot it down, verses 35 through 42, the apostle describes this in more detail, how God plants a seed, but it's raised up. It's the same, but it's raised up in a whole new person. You plant a seed, and all of it, and it looks like an acorn. When it grows up, it looks different, but it's the same. Well, the Lord uses a different analogy here. He likens existence in the world to come to the angelic realm, which is to say that we'll have no fear of death because death will have been conquered. Angels don't die, and we won't die anymore either. And because of that, there'll be no more need for marriage. Because one of the prime reasons for marriage in the first place, in the creation mandate, was the propagation of the race. I know there are other reasons for marriage, good reasons. But one of the reasons, as it came from God, was to propagate the race, to fill the earth. I was talking about this yesterday with a friend. We were joking. People in a bad marriage find this concept really agreeable to them. But most people that are married, we love each other, and you really struggle with this idea. This person that I'm become one flesh with, that we get in heaven and we won't be married anymore. Well, the only way to understand it, to come to grips with it, is to contemplate that we will be so caught up in a new experience of glory and worship of God and of enjoying the Lord, that there will truly be no loss involved. Like the angels, our great purpose, our great center in heaven will be communion with God and learning more about Him and glorifying Him and worshiping Him. In marriage, we develop such a love, such an affection that is difficult to contemplate. Being together, even in heaven, without having that monogamous kind of bond that is expressed in the Bible as one flesh. But I like what Kent Hughes said in regard to this. To be sure, there will be no marriage in heaven and no concern about past husbands or wives, but that does not suggest in the slightest a reduction in love. We will be in heaven at ourselves at our ultimate best, and we will be more lovable and more loving and more capable of loving than ever before. So this may be a difficult thing to grasp in our fleshly state, but we're asked to accept them in faith. The Sadducees weren't prepared to do that, though. They were not men of faith. They rejected that kind of spirituality. That recognized revelation and illumination. They were dependent only upon their own reason, and they thought the principles that were set forth in the Pentateuch. The result was, as the Lord said to them, they were ignorant of the Scriptures and ignorant of the power of God. But the Lord uses those Scriptures to give them the evidence that there must be resurrection and that it's grounded in God's covenant relationship with the redeemed. And I won't have time to really spin on verse 26, except to say this. He quotes from the Pentateuch for their benefit, Exodus 3:6. It's one of the most sacred and important passages in all the Scriptures for all Jews. It's the passage where God speaks to Moses out of the burning bush. He wants him to go back to Egypt, set his people free, and in order to inspire him and in giving courage, he tells him, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. And that's what Jesus quotes to the Sadducees. And he adds in verse 27, he's not the God of the dead, but of the living. You're greatly mistaken. It's an overpowering argument looked at from several angles. One way you look at it, you say, well, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not I was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But the most important thing to recognize, and I do want to get this in, is the identity of the men cited in God's revelation to Moses. They are the patriarchs of the Jews. They are the men with whom God made his unbreakable covenant with them. In that covenant, he had promised to them a great nation and a land that they would possess forever. But Abraham never possessed the land. The proof of the resurrection, as it came from the Lord's lips this day, was grounded in the immutability of God and in the trustworthiness of God in his word. The only way that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all of whom died in the fashion of all mortal beings, the only way they could receive the promises of the covenant would be through resurrection. God would raise them up again, and to believe otherwise was to make God a liar. That's what the Sadducees had been doing. They'd been making God a liar in their ignorance of the scriptures and of the power of God. Well, that's it. We're citizens, ultimately, of heaven, not just earthbound materialists. We may act as though this world is all there is, but God promises us that it's not, and that prospect ought to energize us to live heavenly lives today. We are to render to God the things that are God, and that means everything. Total consecration. I always enjoy it when the Holy Spirit takes the song that we start the class off with singing, and I see in it the lesson that's coming. O love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean depths its flow may richer, fuller be. That's the lesson. I give it back, the life I owe. God help us to do that. Father, thank you for what you have given us. All the material blessings that we have, but most of all, the promise of a life in eternity in your presence. In response, Lord, give us grace to give our lives back to you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.